IVM
Public policy affects every aspect of your life, from the roads near your home and the lakes in your city, to education and health, to international trade and foreign policy. If you want to understand this interplay of politics, economics, polity and governance, Takshashila Institution's public policy courses are made just for you. The 12-week graduate certificate program gives you a window into the basics of public policy. You can choose to explore the areas of defense and foreign affairs, tech and policy, or advanced public policy. The course is completely online and is conducted on weekends, making it a perfect fit for working professionals. The applications for the May 2024 cohort are now open. Visit school.takshashila.org.in. For more information, visit www.school.takshashila.org.in or click the link in the show notes.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy, your favorite daily public policy podcast from the Takshashila Institution. I'm Anushka Saxena, your host for this episode and a research analyst with the Takshashila Institution's Indo-Pacific Studies program. And today I'm joined by a very special guest. She's Neha Mishra, an executive officer for policy and international affairs at the Society of Indian Defense Manufacturing, Confederation of Indian Industry. And she also happens to be one of the fellows in the pioneer cohort of Takshashila's flagship Network for Advanced Study of China Fellowship. She also happens to be the winner of one of the top five papers announced as part of the fellowship in March 2024. Neha, welcome to this episode. I'm so glad to host you today.
Thank you so much, Anushka. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Likewise, Takshashila offered the opportunity to be a part of NAS Fellowship, and I'm so happy to if I can share any points about my paper today.
Right, excellent. That is the hope today, Neha, to discuss some of the points that you've made in your research paper as part of the fellowship, which is titled The Prospects of China's Dominance in Critical Mineral Supply Chains. And, you know, this happens to be a very hot topic. In fact, we had three papers on this particular theme, critical minerals as well as rare earths, as part of the fellowship. And of course, you were on the panel where the three papers were being discussed. And, you know, you preface your paper by arguing that over the past few decades, China has strategically positioned itself as the dominant force in the critical mineral value chains. It started with mining, moved on to production, finally processing. And it has also employed a bunch of tactics such as offering low prices and operating costs to make other countries kind of rely on China for raw materials or manufacturing or the technology to process critical minerals. And at the same time, you also set the backdrop by arguing that while global commitment to energy transition is kind of on the rise and global demand at the same time is expected to quadruple by 2040 for critical minerals, this kind of overdependence on China can further risks in supply chains. And, you know, the main crux, as you say, of your paper is that going forward, because of a bunch of policy tools other countries are applying, there is going to be less China, but not necessarily zero China in the critical mineral supply chains. So I'm going to touch on all of these points, Neha, and come to the expert on this. My first question to you would be just to set a little context for our listeners. What do we mean when we say critical minerals, right? What makes them critical? What are these categories? And what are the stages of their processing? What does the critical mineral supply chain look like? So just on that background, Neha, I'm going to give the floor over to you.
Thank you, Anushka. I also want to share this that when I applied, I also got to know that three papers were there on critical minerals. And frankly, when I started working on critical minerals, there were at least no one I could know of my age at least who is working on critical mineral sector. So I was very happy that, okay, some people are working, they're interested at least. So yeah, one side is that. And thank you for introducing my paper in such a summarized good way. To answer your first question, that what are critical minerals and their supply chain looks like. So before we understand critical minerals, we need to understand the criteria for a mineral to be called as critical, because the definition of a critical minerals varies according to the time and space they are being used. So it's a very temporal spatial difference, if you see, because in one time currently, if rare earth is very important, it might be a possibility that after 10 years, it might not be critical of that time or that requirement. So every country has very different way of defining critical minerals according to their need and time. But most of the time, their definition has a very common way of defining it. Mostly the factors they consider is geological scarcity, geopolitical issues, trade policy, or most importantly, a critical mineral is something which serves as an essential function in one or more energy technologies, including that technology that produce or transmit or store or conserve any future technology, or especially energy or clean technology. So, but at the same time, if you see the supply chain, due to the commercial geography of each critical minerals, all nations import critical minerals because few of them hasn't, because it's very localized in some countries. Not every country has the reserve available. And the related technology is also very specific to one country. It depends on the technological capacity and strength of one country. So it kind of continues the dependence of one country on another for a steady demand for all these resources. Thus, they require to need a very well-functioning global market and sustain the supply chain. And there comes CEM, obviously China's role, because it has done very strategically, it has used its dominance over all the levels. If you see the critical minerals, there are multiples, but right now the main ones which I have found by reading the critical mineral list of around 7-8 countries which have came up with a critical mineral list in past 10 years. The most common ones were lithium, antimony, beryllium, cobalt, germanium, graphite, and so on, and rare earth especially, because that has been my major focus over the time. So if you see, lithium is available in Australia, Chile has copper and lithium, cobalt is in Democratic Republic of Congo, nickel is in Indonesia. So these are some of the examples. But at the same time, China's strength comes not only this in the reserve sector, it comes in the supply chain at all the levels. There, I would like to explain that when you are thinking of supply chain, any country can be present in the supply chain of any mineral. But you can get the control of the supply chain by having the control over the value chain, where China has really worked upon and obviously aced it over the past few years or decades. So that's what everybody who is listening right now should understand, how critical mineral strategies and critical mineral supply chain works.
Right, right. That makes sense. So you've clearly highlighted that most countries have a geographical component to it, that, you know, some minerals can be critical because they're only located or concentrated in specific geographical regions. You give the example of Australia, Chile, DRC, Indonesia, right? So there's that component, and that's the reserve part of it, like you said. But that's not all. You said that there is also a component of disruptive power in the geo-economic domain, right? So some of these elements, along with being, you know, concentrated in terms of reserves, should also kind of be those where some countries have a disproportionate share in production or substantial exports or advanced research and development, right? So yeah, that makes sense. And of course, you touched upon the fact that China has capitalized on some of these value chains as opposed to supply chains as a whole, because you said any country can have a role in supply chain. So what exactly is China's policy toolkit which has led it to, say, dominate said value chains? What has it done right? And what is its overall role in the supply chain or the value chain?
Right. So when you take the case of value chain, I was also coming to that. Then I thought maybe it's going too much into the question. So about the value chain, if you are available in a supply chain of any critical mineral or any resource, commodity, anything, our country should have the capacity at all levels available in its own country. For instance, China has mining capacity, production capacity, and processing capacity available in its country at the same time. Where the other countries are relying on processing capacity on other countries, mostly on China. But now they are diversifying, so they are moving to other countries. But at the same time, when you have every possible aspect of one technology available, let's not take the case of critical mineral. If we take the case of any commodity right now, if you are supplying the raw materials to other country and the manufacturing is being made in the other country where you are supplying, then that country has the more power on the value chain of that commodity than the country who is exporting. So there, if you take the example of China, China is exporting, but it has the capacity to export raw material as well as the manufactured materials. So there, China has the major advancement or major leverage over other countries. And in terms of having the control over supply chain, the policy tool has been this only that how over the years, China has been one part I have told you that strategically it has been investing a lot in the critical mineral sector, but at the same time, the research and development part, because the world has seen multiple countries to enter into this domain and then back out. Some countries have the reserves still, they are not the part of the value chain and even the supply chain. So how China went into all this? Because of its research and development capacity. Over the years, it has worked on it through multiple policies. It has incorporated critical minerals in its main policies, like the five-year policy framework and so on. While other countries have missed out on it in the last years, but now they are entering into the domain, which is a separate discussion over it.
Right. So that's an interesting point that you mentioned about the fact that countries have missed out on maybe capitalizing upon the opportunity to not just name minerals and identify minerals as critical, but also then to shape the policy architecture domestically to be a more integrated part of the value chain. But you argue that China has successfully done that. So just quickly, can you talk about maybe some of the policy proposals that China has come out with? For example, what was the earliest recognition of, say, a critical or a strategic mineral in Chinese media or Chinese policy nomenclature or lingo? And then maybe how has that policy setup evolved? You know, just some key maybe policy milestones that perhaps the Chinese domestic architecture has witnessed. Any thoughts on that?
In that case, mostly which I also read when I was starting my research in critical mineral sector, the main element I started with was rare earth minerals, rare earth elements. So there I read and realized that when China strategically entered into the domain of critical minerals, it was firstly the rare earth elements. There it came up with the first statement, which is very famous throughout the world, that the leader Deng Xiaoping, he stated that if Middle East has oil, China has rare earth. So that was the main statement that made that China brought to the world, that we have the confidence over the rare earth strength right now. And that continuously changed over the time, how it started as a confidence and it converted into a geopolitical leverage over the countries, and then the overconfidence, and now it is shaping into other domain or other taking a different kind of nature right now. So just to answer very briefly, that if you take the case of all the critical mineral sectors or critical minerals in China, China has the capacity to control the value chain of all the critical minerals right now. But rare earth is the main key China had. Why? Because the policy, if you're talking about, the policy started to focus only on the rare earth sector initially. And then it shifted to other critical minerals, considering the requirement of the clean energy and the energy transition in future. So that is one thing. And the second part is that China has been, as I have explained, that it has been working on the research and development part. And the most important part, which I have noticed, that in 1980s, when the legislation throughout the world by IAEA was imposing all over the countries that you have to stop mining the rare earth, especially on US, and that made US to control its mining and even put a stop on its mining sector. there China could survive and could even start the rare earth industry of its own because of its research and development. Because there, who is also called as the father of Chinese rare earth industry, he came up with a new chemistry formula which can reduce the environmental impact of the rare earth mining, unlike other countries did not have. But at the same time, it could not sustain for a longer time, and China is still working on new policies, new initiatives, new research every day to work on its dominance in every certain way. So that is one, that is the most important part which I feel China has been advancing upon, which other countries are working now. So that is the one thing which has made me realize. And even during my interview of mine with other interviewers, with other experts, I realized that China has been always thinking 10 years ahead of other countries, especially in terms of critical minerals.
Right, right. So that makes sense. So another interesting point like you made is about, helping out with environmental sustainability. And you say that in China, that has been achieved, but other countries are still thinking about it, articulating policies about it, right? And I think that's one of the things that historically, like you said, the IAEA legislation and others have also focused on, that, you know, how mining can impact the environment and what can kind of be done about it, given that both critical mineral demand and supply isn't going anywhere. So I'm going to come to that in a little bit, but let me circle back to one of the points you made earlier about the different nature that China's dominance in critical mineral supply chains is now taking, right? And by different, I assume you mean that countries are now looking at it more critically, if I may say so, right? Countries are now kind of looking to reduce their dependence on China, and the geopolitical environment has kind of shifted from under maybe China's feet. So on that, what do you think the sentiment, the geopolitical sentiment around the dominance of China in these supply and value chains is, and what policy subsequently do you observe other countries adopting to kind of take a step back and reduce some of it?
So as I also have explained on address in my paper, I have divided the China's presence in the critical mineral supply chain based on all the trends, three phases. First and second phase, I have already talked about the emerging dominance, how China relies about the critical minerals and worked on it, its capacity, and developed its strength from an importer to a primary exporter. And then came up the geopolitical leverage that is still going on, and how China used its primary exporter standpoint, or maybe the position, to geopolitically and strategically use it against the countries to have a leverage over them. And now the third, which I have just mentioned, changing the nature. Then how China has shifted its approach, or maybe also the policy, to sustain the dominance right now. That is also emerging, and it has been in notice from last 3-5 years, because China has been enlarging its presence in other all the sectors to just sustain the dominance it can in any way. So there I have, explained to you, that the countries are already understanding that the over-dependence on any single country, not only China, if you take the case of any single country, if you're relying on a single country, the supply chain security is not there. So that's why the countries are realizing to go towards supply chain diversification. And thus, the diversification can only come through working on their interdependence from other levels, not only relying on one country. Yes. And then if we take the case of China, yes, China is also diversifying. That is one thing, because other countries, as I just mentioned, that China is thinking 10 years ahead of other countries. So now the countries are realizing that we need to diversify. China started to realize the need of diversification maybe 5 years back, because China started investing in African countries which have a high reserve potential, but at the same time they are not very interested to enter into the supply chain politics or any kind of geopolitics. But where China can use its geoeconomic capacity, invest in these countries, lure them with its financial status and position and then extract their resources according to its own needs. So there it can also ignore the environmental aspect because it is not mining in its own country, and also it can reserve or sustain the supply of the raw materials for future, because the key power of China is its processing capacity. That is most important to remember. So if it is importing the raw materials from these countries, like Myanmar is right now the major source, and from Africa, it is Madagascar, and Djibouti is also there. So from these countries, it can import raw materials, and then it can process and make the manufactured product and can export to other countries. So that is one thing which even the countries with reserve cannot do. So they are already engaging in the geoeconomic arrangement with China to sustain their economic advantage. And China is already luring them with all these, because China has been the largest geoeconomic player since 2011 only. So this is one separate conversation we can have later. And then to sustain the dominance, we have seen that China has been working, as I have explained, to invest in the critical mineral raw materials strength countries. For instance, it has been investing in Chile for copper. It has been investing in South Africa for manganese, in Australia for lithium, in Myanmar for tin, in Philippines for nickel, and for cobalt in DRC. These are some examples I'm giving to you. There are a lot which we don't know because exactly we don't have the access to the data with China. That will share that easily. But these are the data which are available open source. And that is not very limited amount of investment or import from these countries. It is in very high amount which China has been importing from last 5 years. It has been increasing year by year. So one thing is this. Second are the policies. If we have seen as I have explained, the political leverage, whenever China has been working on its resource access. So when China at its national interest or national domestic demand is increasing, it puts in resource tax. And whenever the resource tax is there, production quota is there, the world price is going to increase. That is one of the big challenges for the world. Then China is issuing multiple guidelines for its industrial carbon peaking and even working on promoting the green development of non-ferrous metal industry, that is critical mineral industry. So that it can also justify or legitimate all the environmental regulation or imposition over it throughout the world. And then it comes the most important is which recently has merged. It's all the state-owned entities that are working on critical mineral sector, especially rare earth elements, into single entity to increase the transparency among all of them and to reduce the illegal mining throughout the country, because illegal mining is one of the most biggest challenge to China right now, and just to develop the efficiency throughout the country. So these are some of the examples which I have seen China is trying to work on, which is still in progress in other countries, which will take still more than 10 years or maybe 15 years in other countries. So that is why I think, yeah, the sustenance, the new phase is emerging. The new nature of China's dominance is emerging.
A lot to unpack there. And like you said, we probably don't have time to get into all of it. But it seems to me that the strategy is a bunch of centralized domestic policies, including mergers of various state-owned enterprises and a crackdown on illegal mining to kind of centralize the entire process and create one large, maybe mega corporation that can help sustain China's dominance. And of course, China alone cannot be a dominating force in the critical mineral supply chains until and unless it has partnerships with these other relatively smaller countries on imports, on finding reserves, and of course, like you said, making not just tiny, but very substantial investments, right? And of course, who knows, like you said, where the extent of these go. So in that sense, and you know, just to kind of reiterate the question I asked you before, is diversification working out? What are some of the tools countries can maybe rely on to diversify? Can they make even bigger, more substantial investments in some of these smaller partners that China has to take away from some of what China has gained? Or can they develop a policy architecture of their own domestically. What is it some of them can do or are doing?
So in terms of diversification, as I already explained how China is working on it, in terms of other countries, it is going, I won't say it's going great, but it's not something, it's not going anywhere. So the diversification initiative among high import dependence countries are really there. Since 2011, when we had the Senkaku Diaoyu Island dispute between China and Japan, when China imposed export embargo against Japan, against the geopolitical clash, that really affected Japan's automobile industry and also its GDP for next two, 3 years. So that then that made the countries which are really high import dependent on were or high import dependent countries on China, they started to diversify in every certain way. But most important country which I have noticed throughout my research that was Japan, because Japan never went back to China like other countries did. Japan still continued to import from China, but it tried to reduce import dependence from China year by year. And currently, that is the most important part, which I have also mentioned in my paper, that Japan has no reserve capacity of critical minerals. Rare earth, it has nothing. But the production capacity, they're still working on it. Through what? Recycling capacity. A capacity which is really in future. A capacity which is, I think China is already working on it. So there is one diversification initiative which Japan has been eased on. And then comes the case of Australia and USA. Australia is the, or USA is the second largest producer of rare earth. And Australia is also third or fourth largest producer of rare earth. So they have jointly working together since that year only. And from when trade war happened in 2018 between China and USA, they tried to push that initiative further and have been working in to develop their joint collaboration in certain ways, especially when we have seen POD, when it tried to focus on critical mineral. And then recently it has been launched the Mineral Security Partnership by under the leadership of US. These are some of the examples. And there is also security partnership between India, Japan and Australia. So at bilateral level and at multilateral level, these countries are working every now and then and through multiple policies and initiatives. But at the same time, the most important thing, which if the diversification initiative needs to be successful in the next 10 years, it should be to develop the processing capacity. And I believe that it should be with the, at least 3-4 countries, not be with the single country again, because we might end up in the same situation which we are right now, but it cannot be as well. But the most important part is to have the processing capacity in a way that can, obviously, as my paper has mentioned, that it cannot be zero China, but less China. To make the less China more effective, the processing capacity needs to be more effective. Either with USA or with Australia, I think Australia is working really great right now to work in its processing capacity. Right now, the mining, I just forgot the name, its mining capacity facility it has in Australia, which is working on developing the processing capacity that will be developed by 2030, I believe. And if it will be developed, it can also reduce, or maybe it can also overcome the Chinese dominance, because it can go beyond Chinese capacity, which China currently has. So that is one of the sectors. But again, we are thinking of 2030. It is not next year. It is not next 5 years also. It's next 6 years on. You don't know it will be done by 2030 or not. So this is one of the things which I feel if we have to work, obviously we cannot work very quickly to just attain it and then we have to lose it very in next 5 years. We have to work on a long-term sustenance that can reduce the dependence, but in a more effective manner, not in a very, short-term development is there and then after 5 years, we're again moving back to China. So these are the things I feel are there. So yeah, there will be less China, but zero China.
No, makes perfect sense. And, like you rightly pointed out, diversification efforts cannot be short term. There has to be a goal for long term sustenance. And some of it will kind of also require to take pages out of China's playbook, and maybe multilateral or bilateral partnerships can perhaps prove more effective at a time when you say that individually it will take countries 10 years. And I think the facility that you talked about, you know, the one in Townsville, Queensland, that is coming to be a state-owned enterprise funded by the Australian government. Of course, yeah, they announced it in 21. Their initial target was 25. And, you know, without any lack of substantive progress, seeing as Australia's imports from China have not really reduced, yeah, it could very well stretch to 2030. So, yeah, you rightly make the case that at least for the foreseeable future, there will be no zero China. And of course, this also then creates opportunities for India vis-a-vis the Quad, right? Because the US-sanctioned Quad Critical Minerals Partnership Act could then mean that there will be more concerted governmental effort towards partnerships. So, Neha, I have one final question for you. You've explained how diversification and efforts towards reduction of dependence on China can be made more effective. My final question would be, what do you then think China can or will or is doing to sustain its dominance? What's the next steps for China's role in the critical mineral supply chain?
So as I have already mentioned that how China has been working on multiple policies, multiple initiatives to sustain its dominance. But in terms of the plan is right now, which is looking to me, is it to develop its reserve strength. Not in its own country, but in other countries, which I have already mentioned that how it has been investing here and in other countries. And it can also contribute to further to its production strength. Because when you're mining the reserve, obviously it is affecting your environment. And then comes the production. Production is also affecting your environment. So when it is importing from these countries, based on my analysis, that China will end up into working on the production capacity of these countries as well, so that it can import easily the produced raw material, the produced rare earth ore, for instance, and then it can process it in China. Because I think only the processing capacity is the main key, which China is not going to share that easily. And it will obviously work it out how strategically it is going to do. And then it comes the processing capacity and technology. So currently the processing capacity is there, and the production capacity, if we take about, so reserve is already there, and if it is working, and I think China will work on it based on my analysis, that it will develop the production strength in these countries which has a reserve capacity right now, so that it can import those produced, for instance, rare earth ores in China and process it. Processing capacity is the main key China has over that gives it more power over the country, which is, I think, it won't be sharing very easily. And if it will be, I feel it will be obviously doing very strategically. That I personally feel. And then comes the processing capacity and technology. So processing capacity, it is working right now. It needs to, and it will be working to improvise it, to develop more efficiency through multiple technological development. And yes, R&D is the main power of China, which has been working right from last 20 years, more than four decades, I feel, since 1980s. And it has been growing every year. So if China is seeking the dominance, it will continue to do so. And the domestic policy, which has linking these strategic minerals, the critical minerals, needs to, and I think it has been developed since 2015 more, when China incorporated critical mineral first time in its 5-year policy. And then it also added in the critical mineral list that was in 2016. It was the first country that came up with a critical mineral list of its own. And then other countries have followed up. Even India has came up with list right last year. So there, the strategic domestic policies, which has been favoring the development or evolvement of these critical mineral sectors, that is one of the main strength of China. And I think it will continue to do so. And if it not, it should do if it wants to sustain. But yeah, at the same time, the G2G interaction is still declining. As we have seen, the diversification is increasing. And a decade ago, more than 90% of the world used to import rare earth from China. It has gone down to a very down level. I currently don't remember the current figure, but yeah, it has gone down really, really low. And G2G interaction, if it is declining, the diversification you cannot sustain only through investing in the resource-rich country. A country needs an economically advanced country as well, or also high import-dependent country. If China will continuously work on its capacity to produce, process, and export, where it will go if no country will import from it. So there it has to work on how to develop the G2G interaction with these countries, which it has been losing over the last years. And I think personally, throughout my interviews, I realized that the B2B interaction is still positive about China. For instance, in Europe or in USA, these industries are very, very positive about China, and they have a very strong mutual aid to sustain the business operation with China. But they are restricted by the geopolitical issues. So that is one of the major positive part for China, which if G2G interaction will develop, China will again can have more control over it. So in the end, I would say my analysis indicates that the global community cannot eliminate its reliance on China or its dependence on China, but it significantly can reduce it. But at the same time, China can also work through diversification and also continuing its business or commercial ties with these industries. So because sometimes B2B goes on even if G2G is not there, or to foreign modes or something. So that is one part which I need to work or understand why B2Bs are still working. And but yeah, the diversification initiatives need more than two decades. As I mentioned, processing capacity outside China is still growing. Recycling potential is still in the future. China is still preferable partner for the business or the industries right now. So that is, these are the things that which are being done by China, which should be done by China if it's not in future to sustain it. So yeah, in the last, I would say the tagline of my paper, it will never be zero China, but less China.
Thanks so much for that, Neha. That makes a lot of sense. And I think just to get the gist of it, China is doing really well with B2B interaction, something you said is your springboard for future research. So, you know, good luck with that. It's doing well on processing and R&D. These are two pillars of its dominance in the supply chain, and you know, it would especially, so it'll have to sustain that, and especially on what it can work on more, it'll be, you know, reserves and production. And you know, we know that China kind of holds in its hand 60% of the world's rare earths, but processes nearly 90%, which means that it's importing rare earths from other countries and then processing them. So processing is definitely going to be one of the important pillars going forward, as you rightly pointed out. Thank you so much, Neha. With that, we come to the end of this episode. This host of publications that we've produced as part of the NASC Fellowship, Neha's is one of a part of a larger cohort in which folks have done some excellent research on topics ranging from Chinese domestic politics to Chinese economic and technological ecosystems. They're going to come out soon, and you know, I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy reading some of them in depth because, you know, this is just a teaser, so to say. And we're also going to be soon launching the second cohort of the Network for Advanced Study of China Fellowship. So please keep your eyes peeled out for the applications and the call for proposals. You know, it's going to be talked about in subsequent podcasts. So I'm sure our listeners had a lot to take away from this conversation. And I'd like to thank you, Neha, for your insights. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into another episode of All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.